Blog Talk Radio.
Oh!
everybody to the Dragon's Lair. And tonight's topic is Darwinism. Seems we have a whole lot of people who are new to the racialist and nationalist movements who have, or are being and are have been suckered into this philosophy. And so I want to have that as my show topic tonight. I'm not going to say that I'm going to sit here and talk all night about it. I have some clips to play. Some of them are from my previous shows. But as I've said in the past, why sit here and say something that someone has already said? And in some cases, said it better than I could say it. So with that said, for the record, today is January 15th, 2014 on our screwed up Christian calendar. The sun is at 26 degrees Capricorn. And again, I have no personal website or blog. Probably wouldn't have a life if I did. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. And that is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to be on my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe, or you can just write me. I can't guarantee I can respond to all of my emails, but I will read them. There will be no calls tonight. The dog and cat are inside. The cat's sitting here in the chair with me. I want to remind everybody with state-endorsed holiday coming up, I believe it's on Monday, of the Martin Luther King Jr., that I have three shows that I have done exposing this. I'm not going to call him man. He is a male, but nevertheless. So, if you have not heard them, please listen to them, and if you have heard them, please pass on the links to the shows to others who may have not. This is very important. We have a whole bunch of people out there worshiping this thing without having a clue about the truth of what all he was about and the things that he did or did not do, etc., etc., etc. Now, I'm going to start off with a recently posted article over at The Joy of Satan that I have found to be very interesting and I think will pretty much sum up this whole philosophy, ultimately. It doesn't get into the fine points of rebuttal, but it does indicate very clearly what the purpose of what Darwinism was actually about. And so, without further ado, let me get on over to this next page I've got here. And I'm just going to go ahead and dive in. I'll play some more music a little bit later. Darwin's theories really do not amount, in many cases, to nothing but a pseudo-scientific justification for the continuation of the hierarchical system laid down in the feudal regimes of the system originally created by the Christian theocracy. Darwin was trained to be a minister in the Anglican Church and picked up most of his ideas from Christianity and social beliefs of the time. Why do you think he placed out all of the races on earth with the Irish at the bottom rung of evolution? It reflects the popular attitude in the English upper class of the day towards the Irish and helped to justify their feudal regime in Ireland as well. Darwin took the church's idea of predestination and applied it to biology in a way that it was a continued justification of the dominant caste system in Europe that started with the Catholic idea of the will of God and his government on earth. You have the church and you have the nobles at the top and everyone else in the bottom, mainly as serfs who are owned as chattel of the rulers who are ruled by the church. Essentially, the divine right of kings. This means that you are predestined to be a brutalized serf by the will of God, and any act or thought of rebellion is a violation of God's will. The Bible sets this whole system up. The serfs slave all day and have to give most of what they have to the church, and the nobles are left with just enough to half starve instead of fully starve, if they're lucky. Any serf caught trying to get out of their serfdom were confined or hanged as a runaway. This is how most of Europe lived at that time. Basically, communism with a spiritual pretense. Well into the 18th century, scientific materialism was becoming the new religion, and the ruling classes trying to keep the masses in line and continue their caste system, in other words, the status quo. So they shifted by hook or crook the same theological tenets into vogue under the banner of science. Now it is we are the superior upper classes because of our biological predestination, and the rest of you are born to be our servants, serfs, and general property because you are biologically predestined with inferior or weaker biology. Now God said becomes science said. A mentor of Darwin was the Reverend Malthus, who was the famous pusher of the idea that starving the working poor and social, economic working lower class to death was a kind and good thing, and that it would cause the weaker to die off. And most people were the working poor due to the caste system in Europe at that time. Social Darwinism, by another name. Its ideas were put to reality during the engineered famine that killed 1 million innocent people in Ireland by the Rothschilds that modern historians openly acknowledge as direct genocide. Jesus-loving Malthus, his work helped pave the way for such things. That the idea of improving the socioeconomic state of affairs for the people and ending the serfdom, and that by wage improvements, education improved human rights and freedoms and income increases with labor reforms, any problems would cease to exist, never occurred in the minds of these Judaic freaks, because then they couldn't justify sending children into the mines and mills as work slaves or filling the debtor prisons full of slave labor if those improvements were made. And, of course, they were all put there by the exploitive Jewish banker system. Clear my throat. The abusive system is not the problem. It's actually biologically inferior people, after all. So we are justified in our materialistic enslavement of whole populations to our industry and debt systems and caste society. Of course, the Protestant deification of work served as the backdrop to enslave the population into industrial slavery. It's not an accident that Marxism used the same Darwinian theories to justify its total enslavement of the population into a neo-feudal slavery system as a so-called scientific doctrine to justify in order to justify itself. Of course, social Darwinist ideas were being pushed in the upper classes at the time in America as well. And this is when the Jewish Rockefellers and their agents created the public school system as it is now, which is designed to shut down the right side of the brain and train everyone into systemized drones, fit only for wage slavery and their economic serfdom. People who have had their self-esteem and creative ability destroyed in a new artificial personality assigned to them that is servile and dependent on authority for direction with everything. Right at the time, they destroyed skilled labor and self-employment in America. Then they replaced it with proletarian wage slavery in all of their factories that then destroyed entire families and forced parents to put their kids into adoptive trust that sold their kids off to strangers as cheap farm labor so they would not starve to death. It's also no mistake, after a century of the school system that we have now, the rate of inventions in America has declined. They destroyed the creative part of the mind with their school system. This is why IQ is worshipped and not creativity and personal genius. They created a system where left-brained training is to rule, garbage in, garbage out, removing people removing from people the part of the psyche where their psychic abilities are within them. The key to Tesla's genius, from his own autobiography, was his psychic abilities, which came from the right side of his brain, where the psyche dwells. He stated he would see the object within his mind's inner eye, and all the knowledge of how to create it was downloaded into his mind with the image. Watson, the father of DNA discovery, saw the spiral shape in a deep trance state, which opens one to his Shakti, or right side of the brain, or the psyche, which was the key that unlocked his discovery. In many cases, all that is being pushed by the system is the same doctrine minus the spiritual pretense, where science becomes the new theology, and to the fact that Darwinian evolutionary theories take as much faith to believe in as Jesus. It's just shit and used to push us into nihilism, materialism, atheistic humanism, etc. In other words, the crap that the Jewish communist state is built on. Most of what we call science today is realms of make-believe bullshit that is designed to go nowhere. The Big Bang is bullshit as well and has been debunked over and over. But the theology of science just destroys the careers of the heretics who question it. We are right back to the Catholic Church and the communist system, which put scientists in gulags for discovering any holes in the state's scientific dogmas. And we know what the church did to them. So let me get back over to the studio here. And I'm going to go ahead and play another song. And we'll be right back with the rest of the show.
Yeah.
Okay, what I've got next is a short clip that I did as part of another show when I was on another network. And what I was reading from also came from The Joy of Satan. It's about 3.5 minutes long, and it's about evolution. So let me go ahead and play it for you. Okay, mainstream Darwinian evolution theory takes about as much faith as belief in Jesus, no matter how much Dawkins jumps up and down about it. And Dawkins was a guy that I referred to in the book, The God Virus. He was used as an inspiration. He is an atheist and believes in evolution. Many of you have probably heard of him. And if you listen to my show on The God Virus, you heard his name. No matter how much Dawkins jumps up and down about it, its actual point is to form a scientific basis for communism, which wipes real human history off the table and replaces it with materialistic, communistic nonsense. It comes from a time of low understanding in the nature of reality. Science has become the new theology, and it's just as dogmatic and ruthless in enforcement of its theological canons. The Big Bang has been debunked over and over, but the real scientists who do this simply lose their careers as heretics. The Inquisition is still around. The fact is, life forms do become more complex and subject to change from different rates of light they are based on. Life has been literally proven by uncontrolled science to form out of the subtle ether into being. The physical universe is a spiritual or metaphysical creation. The fact things form out of the ether shows we have souls, as the subtle ether is what the soul is formed of at the base. Things become more evolved, when they increase the amount of light they are formed by. Change the density, change the form. Fact is, life is manifested all the time in a universe without beginning or end, and then constantly changes and becomes more complex and dynamic in consciousness, and then creates dynamic civilizations and migrates out across the worlds and uses their superconscious understanding of the eternal laws of life and creation to create life. The actual science that came out of Russia once the communist regime was gone and that kosher monkey was off their backs, and for once in a half century true scientific freedom was allowed again, shows the ancient Vedic texts were right in their cosmology. In fact, one scholar and scientist who has studied the Vedic text in Sanskrit stated that science is only starting to touch the surface of what the ancient Brahmanas knew. The evidence also shows there was a very advanced civilization on this planet about 4,000 years ago that was destroyed with advanced weapons that were not developed again until about 60 years ago. In fact, they had technology that was not redeveloped until not too long ago. Evolution is the Brahman, not the Darwin. Brahmanada is our destination. This is what the true knowledge of the great perfection rests upon. Okay, I hope that played okay. On my end, it sounded like there were some dropouts in the audio, and I know that there were none in what I uploaded. It should have been okay because I listened to it. I had to go to the trouble of clipping that out of the source show. So, if not, I may replay it at another time. And what I've got next is something that I found on YouTube where somebody had taken the concept of will to power by Nietzsche and did a very good summation of it. And it's about 17 minutes long, and I'm going to go ahead and play it.
The will to power is the central tenet of Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophy. I shall seek to outline it through four aspects. the ontological, the organic, the psychological, and the societal. Nietzsche disavowed the mechanistic pre-Einsteinian physics of his age, sired by Newton. Instead, he argued that what was called matter was in fact a representation of force or energy. This was informed by his readings of Schopenhauer and Boscovich, amongst others, and inspired by Heraclitus. All is force against force, nothing more. Now, the physics of his age, and the general physics of today, consider only the objective aspect of matter-energy, the relational properties accessible to all. Following especially the arguments of Schopenhauer, Nietzsche asserted that there is also a subjective aspect to energy, that is, a subjectivity. This subjectivity is not consciousness as such, it is rather akin to a feeling, a desire, a drive, a will. All forces, which are listed today as being of four types, in their subjective aspect, are this will. This will does not add to the force, it is the force, understood from within. Now, Schopenhauer considered this will to be the will to survive, to maintain itself in its phenomenal differentiation. Nietzsche advances the theory so that the will becomes not the will to survive, but the will to power. The subjective element of energy is a striving to assimilate more energy to its purpose, to its telos, that is its power. Thus, the will to power is a teleological principle that underlies everything. Everything strives for power, for the most subconsciously. Though teleological, the will to power is not a libertarian principle. That is, Nietzsche's not advocating free will. The will to power is not free. In fact, Nietzsche rejects free will along with determinist mechanism because consciousness does not cause actions but merely accompanies them. To be concise, all is force. Force has a subjectivity. That subjectivity is a striving for development, a will to power. Quote, all mechanical events, insofar as an energy is active in them, are really the energy of the will. We designate all effective energy unequivocally as the will to power, the world as it is seen from the inside, the world defined and described by its intelligible character, is simply will to power and that alone. End quote. From this ontological aspect of the will to power is derived the organic aspect. In fact, quote, life is merely a special case of the will to power. End quote. Schopenhauer, and many today, believe that the will to survive, the survival instinct, is the ultimate drive of all organic beings. For Nietzsche, the will to survive is merely the lowest degree of the all-encompassing will to power. If an organism is threatened, it will defend itself, but only because its death would end its power. If a being is not threatened, it will seek to develop, to advance, to grow, to gain power. This is not greed, this is growth. This is reality. The will to power does not, of course, merely apply to humans and other animals, but also plants, fungi, and all else. A tree will seek to grow its roots and gain resources, just as a person will seek to develop his health, strength, wealth, and status. Quote, life itself, in its essence, means appropriating, injuring, overpowering those who are foreign and weaker, oppression, harshness, forcing one's own forms on others, incorporation, and at the very least, at the very mildest, exploitation. Life simply is the the will to power, end quote. Now, an individual organism, so-called, may gain power by entering into a symbiotic relationship with other powers, especially if it is relatively weak. The power of the whole increases the power of the constituents therein. For instance, bacteria can gain advantages by living symbiotically with a human being, who is also thereby advantaged. Further, a human being may gain advantage by being part of a group, family, tribe, state, religion, ideology, etc. It is here where characteristics such as compassion, courtesy, generosity, empathy, etc. can play their part. But always, ultimately, for the power of the group and individuals who are therein united. For Nietzsche, a human being in himself is already a multiplicity of wills to power. Ideally, one will would dominate, giving style, harmony, and direction thereto. Incidentally, in this respect, Nietzsche also moves away from Schopenhauer, as the latter considered an organism to be a single will rather than a multiplicity. For Nietzsche, an organism is a hierarchy. Nietzsche believed in evolution, a theory dating back at least 2,500 years to Anaximander and Empedocles, but he rejected Darwin's version of evolution. He considered it reactive rather than proactive. That is to say that he considered Darwin to presuppose the essence of a life form to be a will to survive that merely reacts and adapts to its environment rather than proactively seeking to dominate its environment, thereby empowering its species. Moreover, Nietzsche advocated soft inheritance, the inheritance of acquired characteristics, rather than the pure neo-Darwinist theory of hard inheritance, the former of which is now re-emerging under the name epigenetics. It is important to note that the will to power is not some vitalistic spiritual principle that exists in addition to a body. Rather, it is numerically identical to the body, but known immanently. It is ontologically one with the body, but epistemically distinct. Our ultimate telos then is power, not pleasure, not knowledge, not fellowship with the gods. For Nietzsche, most pleasure is an after-effect, a byproduct of overcoming an obstacle, that is, of overpowering an obstacle, be that an enemy, an examination, a phobia, fear, anything that stands in one's way. Although people may consciously believe they are acting in order to ultimately attain pleasure or happiness, it is not consciousness that causes one to act. It is will, will to power. Note that, in contrast to most thinkers today, Nietzsche argued that pain, in fact, was not to be devalued. Obstacles cause pain, and only through obstacles can we advance our power. Without obstacles and pain, we would not have evolved into the powerful, complex organisms we are today. Pain is necessary for life. It makes life more advanced. As Nietzsche famously said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So, it is not consciousness that causes actions. In fact, human consciousness itself is a product of the will to power. We only perceive that which was of power importance to us, our ancestors. We are mostly blind to the majority of reality, which plays little role in our power. This is parallel to Henri Bergson's thought. Most of our actions are performed subconsciously. One is not conscious of one's legs' intricate motions when walking, for example. The main role of consciousness is to present to the will, or wills, possible actions vis-a-vis their consequences. The will then determines the action, but which action offers the most power. Being prudent employs consciousness, but one is still determined by the will which seeks power. The will to power is subjective, but it is not the same as human consciousness. Very seldomly do we become conscious of our true nature. The will to truth, the desire for knowledge, is again subsumed under the will to power. Often, gaining knowledge is a means to gaining power. As Francis Bacon stated, knowledge is power. But not always is this the case. Often a falsity will serve us better. Occult dogmas, for example, may deliver more power to the leaders and followers than if the members acknowledged their falsity. In fact, virtually all our beliefs are false. We merely believe what is in our interest, our power interest. There are exceptions, but these are rare. To begin with, our consciousness already delivers us distorted presentations of reality. Our senses are biased. Consequently, Nietzsche is known as a perspectivist because beliefs are based on perspectives of power, albeit subconsciously. A person who feels enslaved will value freedom as its manifestation would yield power to that person. A person who has more power may value justice, as this can be used to earn him ascendance over those more powerful. A person with overflowing power may value the love of humanity, as it is for him his body of control. Indeed, a person of power will be courteous and friendly, and may even genuinely love his enemies, as they present means, obstacles, for him to test his strength. A lion will not be angered over a mouse. His relative power is too great. Defensiveness betrays weakness. Quote, well-meaning, helpful, good-natured attitudes of mind have not come to be honored on account of their usefulness, but because they are states of richer souls that are capable of bestowing and have their value in the feeling of the plenitude of life. End quote. Religious belief, for the most part, is a perspective based on subconscious power considerations. Nietzsche singles out Christianity, which for him is a perspective of the weak. It offers metaphysical punishment to your enemies, as a real physical punishment is not an option. It offers an afterlife of eternal peace, only a value to someone who suffers from life. It offers a slave morality of virtues that benefit the weak. Compassion, humility, servility, equal rights, etc. And presents them as objective absolutes. Christianity is itself a power structure originating in an underclass of the Romans, the latter having a different morality based on their perspective of relative power. All morality is false, or rather no morality is absolute or objective. In this, Nietzsche echoes the arguments of the ancient sophists, whom Plato sought to refute, unsuccessfully in Nietzsche's eyes. All characteristics have had their day as virtues or vices, depending on whether they serve the power of their subjects. Even mindless violence was a virtue in Homeric Greece. The danger of Christianity and the slave morality it has spread is, from Nietzsche's own perspective, that it values the weak and mediocre over the great, and as such has halted humanity's power progress. Christianity's legacy is so ingrained within Western culture that alleged atheists even presuppose this perspective's valuation unwittingly. For example, utilitarians such as Mill simply assume as axiomatic that pleasure is of higher value than pain, and that each person should have equal rights when calculating the consequences of an action. Likewise, socialists believe in equality as axiomatic without being able to prove why it is an objective value. For Nietzsche, socialism is tantamount to Christianity without the God. But without the God, there is no sanctioning of the slave moral. When Nietzsche stated that God is dead, he meant that if one does not believe in God, one has no logical right to believe in the morality which this deity ushered in. We must develop and start thinking in terms beyond good and evil, the name of one of his later books. To conclude, the will to power is the fundamental force of all reality. We observe this power as activity around us, but we can feel this power only within ourselves. In its epistemic immanence, it is not spatial, so cannot be measured. But in its objectivity, it is the world and cosmos of which we are a part.
Okay, I'm back. I think that was a very good summation of will to power. And, of course, you notice that he discussed epigenetics. Well, I've got a little piece here that I had read on another show before I was on the last network. But you'll recognize another individual who is in the show with me. They were the host of the show. And this one is about 21 minutes long. And when it's done, I will play another song and then play another piece where Darwinism is refuted.
Okay, let's get back to the concept of the superhuman. I'm sure some there who have questions regarding the chakras. I'll try to give a simple explanation, but you really need to do your own research. Chakras are the code words for the gods, by the way. Each human has a physical body, the flesh and bones part, and an energy body that distributes the energy to the physical body, just like the physical body has the heart, the blood vessels, and the various organs. The energy body has chakras, which are energy centers, and nadis, which are energy pathways, just like the earth, just like the heart pumps blood through the veins, the chakras pump energy through the nadis. You cannot normally see the chakras, but you can certainly feel them. You can feel them pulsate when they're working. It is very common for a lot of people. The chakras usually pulsate when you do intense physical exercise. The physical body needs the energy, and the chakras work more to supply the energy to the body. The chakras, by the way, will not be found in an autopsy, but they are there. The Kundalini yoga practice is a practice wherein meditation is used to awaken the chakras of the body. The human spine is analogous to the sacred Kundalini serpent, ascending from its coiled position up the spine into activity. This process is considered a beneficial meditative journey, which will inevitably help the participant to become a better person and have a better understanding of himself and their position in the universe. Any type of chakra work, Kundalini or otherwise, is geared towards connecting the participant with the chi, the prana, the vril, there's many words for it, etc., or basically the natural energy of the universe. So Kundalini yoga is meant to empower the spirit while simultaneously connecting the participant with the energy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the best explanation, but I hope that helps. Okay. Let's see here. Related to that, Nietzsche in this superhuman. Some of this I've read before, but I'm going to read it again. There's, I think, about four paragraphs, but I think I can get through to it. And I want to touch on one item before we get to the one other item before we get, now that I see it in my list. before we get to the Samhain and Beltane issues.
Okay.
So let me proceed without any hesitation here. Okay. What Nietzsche called the essence and what Nietzsche called the master morality is having a lifestyle culture based on the evolutionary practice that creates the God-man or the superhuman, the Übermensch. I want to interject and rehash from the previous shows here, and there will be some new material in here as well. The most insidious thing that the right-hand path systems have done, and the right-hand path would be Abrahamic, is to change the meaning behind the symbols and concepts of the original religions, even stealing images and titles of the popular religions to create a Trojan horse virus to act as a battering ram and knock down and replace the original they are a corrupted copycat of. The final insult is that they then parade around and claim they are the original model and those other systems were simply a corruption of theirs. The essence of all enemy systems' point of convergence is the corruption of the true spiritual language by changing the concepts, the meanings, and valid spirituality till it's nothing more than a ritualized slave morality that is designed to domesticate humanity with each generation into a cattle-like state. The dairy cow of today was once the famed mighty Aurochs, A-U-R-O-C-H-S, of old.
Wow.
Nietzsche understood this and termed it the slave morality, which process and final aim was the Undermen, the human cattle, which is the goals of the Judenrats for us. Interesting enough, in the Far East, such beings are called Pashu, or an animalistic being. The ancient spiritual masters acknowledge in that the term the degeneration effects of what a lack of spiritual practice has. How the enemy domestication program works is simple. The brain is interconnected with the chakra centers, which are the macrocosm of the genetic or DNA information code in the body. By programming the mind via ideological software downloads, this then reformats the neural pathways in the brain, or it's like a hard drive, which correspond to the programming command or a vibration frequency or filters. This interfaces with the chakra centers that send this program code into the overall energy body and imprints it into the genetic information code via epigenetics. No, we discussed that word earlier.
Right. Yep.
Thus switching the overall psych into the program frequency. This plugs into the mass mind and then becomes locked in the program due to the program frequency. This plugs in, plugs into the...
Well, you mentioned that it was from the Indian thing, the Pashu?
The Pashu? This plugs into the mass mind and becomes locked in program due to the collective psychic power of the mass mind. Part of this enemy paradigm is the removal of spiritual knowledge and the removal of advanced humans out of society by murdering them and their bloodlines. The killing of them cuts the head off of the original system and the head of the new system rules. Communism is the open practice of this, and it culls out the most advanced genetics, always. The other side of this is a daily practice of meditation, which undoes the programming codes. It cleans out all the imprints with blasts of higher vibrational flow and reformats the psyche to how it should be naturally on a higher level of vibration. The enemy program is low-density frequency waved. It cannot last in the psyche after the practice has advanced with some time. It also strengthens the bioelectrical field to where it blocks or shields one from the mass mind part of the enemy program. It is no different than radio waves on a lower dial having no effect on a higher wave station. This sends a higher vibration into the DNA, which is literally a vibrational information code that interacts with and forces the whole being. You change the code, you change the form, because the form is vibration. So you end up with an advancing human again, metagenics. The essence of what Nietzsche calls the master morality is having a lifestyle and culture based on such an evolutionary practice that creates the God-man, the superhuman, or the Übermensch by a literal transmutation of genetic code, just what Hitler was describing in that quote. As
right.
advancing humans have children, and those children grow up doing the same path and on, you can now see where this leads. The enlightenment process works on the metagenic level and on sending a higher wave of light energy through the entire being, reforming them to a higher level. Still in time, they are perfected to the microcosm frequency or octave of the sun star, the gold in the work. That ends that section. Now, for the divine feminine, I wanted to discuss this. Let me take a drink of water here.
Absolutely.
Okay, I want to make something clear here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of references to turning men into women, turning them gay, and
mm-hmm.
making women into men. This is not the same. This has nothing to do with that. That is a whole separate issue and a whole other ball game. This is all on a spiritual level. Now, Kyle did a show on this. I don't remember which one, but he had a guest for a couple hours. But I wanted to just go over one long paragraph here real quickly that I
sure.
thought was very fitting, and I think that most people can absorb, and it's related to what we just discussed. Most people are not even close to understanding this again. Now, this is also a reference to, in the occult world, a phrase known as darkness. The association of darkness with Satanism has been totally twisted. This is not about spooks, ghouls, or any other crap like that. Satanic darkness has to do with the yin in the yang. This represents the female side of the soul, the subconscious mind that we access through meditation. The serpent of Satan is of the female side of the soul. The male side of the soul is the logical side, the left brain. The female side is the right side of the brain. The soul has both positive and negative poles. Both the male and the female must work together. The logical male side, the left brain, directs the female side through thought and will. The female side of the soul is the powerhouse of the soul. The female side makes manifest the thoughts and ideas generated from the male logical side. The female side is also the creative aspect of the soul. Dreams, music, feelings, intuition. Because of the power to direct one's own destiny and spiritual freedom that comes with this are of the female side of the soul. Christian churches and their related ilk, such as Islam, worked at promoting an inferior image of women, with Islam being brutal to women and the incessant degeneration of women in the Judeo-Christian Bible. All of this is, in addition, reflects on the subconscious, subliminal level to suppress and deny the female power of the soul.
Wow. Yeah.
Through centuries of this enforced garbage, which is nothing more than a program to remove spirituality, the female side of the soul and its powers have atrophied. This is why humanity and this world are in such an ugly mess right now. This has created a most serious imbalance that has become generational. Satanism works through power meditation to empower the female side of the soul to regain balance and restore spiritual health, along with empowering the individual. This has to regain balance and restore spiritual health, along with empowering the individual.
Do you think, David, real quick, I have a quick question here. Do you think that the Jehovian concept, which is basically Jewish, you know, it denies the female energy, it denies the female power, which is basically that they defame as Lucifer in their own text, to deny the female energy, to put everything out of balance. That also goes in league with the pedophilia, the perverseness within the Jehovian religion hierarchies, which I think we see
sure.
today. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
In fact, if you read carefully what Jehovah does, thinks,
mm-hmm.
says, etc., you'll find that Jehovah is a homosexual.
Right, absolutely. And so they hate, they actually hate the woman, they hate the vagina, they hate the female, and they actually want to completely destroy that balance of female energy in this realm, which is how they keep power over us, which is very important. And I just want to throw that in there, man. And go ahead, Dave.
Okay, I'm back. Actually, it was about 12 and a half minutes long, not 20 minutes long. And so there you have a further elaboration on will to power. I want to clarify something here, too. You know, I don't want to imply that homosexuality is related to pedophilia, okay? But the God Jehovah is clearly against women, hates women, et cetera, et cetera. And if you read the story of David in the Bible, you will see that he actually, almost in a way, seems to be a homosexual. Now, I'm not judging homosexuality either, okay? I'm just looking at it from the perspective of denying the feminine. So, and what I'm going to do here is I'm going to play one more song, and then I'll come back and play a long clip. So I'll be right back.
Face, dark through my dreams.
Okay, I'm back. Now, this last clip is an hour and 20 minutes long, so we're definitely going to go into the second hour, or rather the third hour, not the second. And if you want to hear the whole thing, you'll have to call in right before the end of the second hour and listen over the phone, or just wait and download it later. So without further ado, here we go.
Well, we have a somewhat controversial subject, but we're going to handle it as delicately as possible and refrain from all unnecessary downgrading of the efforts of Mr. Darwin. It seems, however, that in the last 5 or 10 years especially, a conflict has arisen in society which no one really expected. And at the present time, two hypotheses concerning the origin of man have come into a collision. This collision course is particularly discomforting to the scientific community, because it has been generally assumed throughout the fields of higher education that we were safely, solidly, and serenely Darwinian in our explanations of the origin of human life. To suddenly find that it's not true, or it is being questioned, is a shock which is creating considerable repercussion in various walks of society. Now, the first question we may ask is, why has this particular issue come into focus? I think for one reason, for nearly 100 years, science has been the white hope of the world. We have assumed that science was going to lead us into the golden age, that science was going to bring about world peace, world security, world wealth, that everything was going to go very well, and that there was no need for us to contemplate any spiritual mystery in the background of life. This attitude has changed markedly since the development of nuclear armament. We suddenly begin to question the moral integrities of the scientific hypotheses. We begin to question whether the advancements of science are going to produce the improvements in humanity itself that have been taken for granted down through the years. We are also more or less frustrated in the development of scientific instruments and methodologies. We are now highly involved in the computer and the development of various electronic circuits, etc. All these processes are fascinating to the young, but they do not solve most of the essential problems of humanity. In fact, they ignore them. The computer, instead of contributing, perhaps, to the solution of human employment, is going to create more unemployment. Progress is a way of substituting machines for people. And these machines will ultimately result in a very tragic lack of employment for the human race itself. Also, scientific development of armaments has become a fear factor in human nature. We are more or less convinced that as the result of scientific progress, we are now in a condition and a position in which we could completely obliterate humanity. Now, this does not sound like progress. It sounds more like annihilation. And we begin to wonder why a highly intelligent strata of humanity is willing to go on like this. Why there seems to be no reason in their thinking to slow down destruction or the causes of it. The entire problem is one in which the mind must do what it pleases, whether it results in confusion, chaos, or destruction. Now, a great many millions of human beings who were very much enamored of science have suddenly questioned it. And unfortunately, the scientific community is not rising in a proper manner to defend its own position. Rather, it has a tendency to ignore the wishes, the will, and the fears of the great majority of human beings. They are not responsive to the cries of millions of frightened neighbors and associates. They go serenely on their way on the grounds that that type of progress is inevitable, that it must come, and that any human being who slows it down is a traitor to progress. Now, on the other side of the coin, we have had a little difficulty also with the religious situation. Religion has gradually tried to creep into science. The religious point of view has finally come head-on into conflict with this scientific materialism. Now, there is a good reason, perhaps, for this. But unfortunately, we are also having a little trouble religiously. And the religious difficulties are giving strength and a measure of sufficiency to the scientific difficulties. In other words, if we pick trouble with science, science is in a position to return the compliment. And this is not the way it should be in life. What no one seems to be willing to face at the present time is the simple fact that both the materialistic and the religious attitude towards humanity, both of these attitudes are hypotheses. Science cannot prove its theory any more adequately than religion is able to support its concept of the origin of life. Actually, religion has a little the better of it, but this is not generally recognized. One of the reasons it has the better of it is that the religious point of view is very much older than the scientific. And as we study antiquity and the various systems of knowledge that arose in ancient times and have descended to us today, we find that there has been no major school in the past that has taken the Darwinian attitude. There has been no time in the development of the human ideologies that the concept of man arising from the animal kingdom has received any popular or thoughtful support. It was never part of our great philosophical heritage from the past. Yet we are not in a position to prove that the ancients were unable to arrive at this conclusion if they had wished to do so. The very antiquity that gave us mathematics, astronomy, music, physics, medicine, was certainly in a condition to study the nature of man. And it did. But it never took the turn toward the Darwinian concept. It was never assumed in antiquity that the human being either ascended from or descended from the animal kingdom. Yet the ancient was well aware of animals. He was well aware of the environments in which they existed. He used domesticated animals. He hunted wild animals. And in Alexandria, in Egypt particularly, zoological gardens made available a very careful study of animal habits and peculiarities. Yet never once among the greater minds of the past has the theory of evolution, as represented by Darwin, taken hold. It was never a method of answering the situation. Antiquity approached the matter in an entirely different way, but it was more or less honest also. Most of the ancients were willing to accept without question that first cause is beyond human comprehension. Now, we may say that this is not true. We may be able to intellectualize a concept of first cause. Antiquity did this. But no matter how it was developed or how it was supported or how it was interpreted, it remained an hypothesis. It was an approach to something, the substance and essence of which was beyond human comprehension. As science and philosophy and religion all rose together in antiquity and were only separated in a comparatively recent period of time, it is also obvious that the scientific position is also hypothetical. And both conditions are theories. They are postulates and postulations until we are able to answer the questions relating to first cause and answer them successfully. Before we can tell how life operates, we must answer the question, what is life? What is this energy? What is spirit? What is mind? What is consciousness? What is energy? What is force? We all realize that these processes, these aspects of existence exist. But we are not yet in a position to find a dogmatic definition for any of them. The only way we can define them, even now, is by defining in terms of the consequences of their activities. We do not know what they are, but we are trying to find out, and in some degrees have been successful, in finding out what they do. But their essence is beyond calculation. We are unable definitely to discover the essential principles behind existence. We'd like to overlook this and simply deny it. One of the most common scientific attitudes is that when we ask the question why, we should assume that it is the question how. We know how things operate, but we do not know why. We do not know what they are, but we believe we can classify some of the things that they do. As far as the final answer to the mystery of life is concerned, it has eluded us from the beginning. The ancients accepted this truth, namely, that the true and final definition is not available. The complete fact of any of the important questions that we ask, this fact is not available. If we do not know why life exists, what it is, where it came from, why it produces this vast concatenation of forms and creatures, until we get some of these answers, all dogmatism is unreasonable. And yet dogmatism is nearly always based upon ignorance. It is not based upon what we know. It is an effort to defend ourselves against what we do not know. Therefore, today, we have a problem. How did man come into existence? What is the story of life? What is the story of existence? And I think we all acknowledge definitely that the development of the concept of evolution has been useful. Evolution was a more or less obvious answer to a problem that is not obvious. Evolution was a neat way of assuming a sequential progress of life through the various forms of nature in an ascending order from the molecular through the mineral, the plant, the animal, and into the human kingdom. Now, this seemed to be such a neat and trite statement that it was accepted instantly and presented us with the solution to certain secondary procedures in nature, but nothing to do with primary. Even if we prove conclusively that life moves through these kingdoms in an ascending order, we still do not know what that life is, nor do we know why it ascends through these various levels of expression. Some years ago, a discussion was held concerning the possibility of man being a product of the animal kingdom, that somewhere in the remote past, what has been called the missing link, pictured by a very interesting composition by the artist Gabriel Max, that there was a missing link between man and the animal. And that this link was a bridge, and that across this bridge, animals moved to become human. And humanity is more or less an advanced animal creation. And that it has, therefore, the visible components of an animal existence. But something is different. It has been impossible to prove conclusively to anybody's satisfaction that the inner life of the human being is identical with that of the animal. If we wish to assume another hypothesis, it's true, the unfoldment of form in nature through the various kingdoms as we recognize them. Apparently, the final purpose of this unfoldment is the creation of bodies, and that these bodies become the vehicles of energies and forces superior to themselves. It is becoming practically untenable in the knowledge that we possess today to assume that the body and the person in the body, that these two constitute one identical being. The body and the person are separate. The person may function through the body and may gradually mold the body into the likeness of its own purposes. But the person and the body are separate beings. Science is reluctant to accept this because to do so would permit the mind to conjure with the thought that if the person is separate from the body, that person can have existence apart from the body. And this is a more or less heretical position in terms of science. It is the opinion of science that the rise and fall of the human being is a complete pattern in itself, that the individual had no existence before his birth and will have none after death. This, however, again, is a hypothetical approach to a problem. No one has yet been able to actually prove that the human being had no existence before birth, and is unable to prove with any conclusiveness that it has any existence after death. For scientifically speaking, however, psychology is producing a wedge by means of which it is making it obvious that it is conceivable that the person and the body have separate existences, and that what we would call embodiment is the entry of a pre-existing pattern into a material existence. If this is the case, and there seems to be increasing support of this belief, then it would follow that various levels of life would be embodied in various levels of bodies. This again presents the scientist with a problem because he would then have to concatenate life itself. He would have to assume that bodies are symbols of the degree of life that is within them. This would mean that the life in the mineral would be less evolved than the life in a plant, and that the life of an animal would be less evolved than the life of a human being. Thus, we would have an evolution of a life through a series of forms or bodies suitable to the expression of that form of life. This constitutes a more or less philosophical approach and more or less agrees with the opinions of antiquity. Transmigration, or the entry of human souls into animal bodies, was never generally recognized. And where it was postulated, it was nearly always in the form of punishment, that to be involved in a less than human body would be a punishment for the human being. The Pythagoreans, however, and most of the Orientals accepted the symbolical meaning, namely, that the individual who lived below the level of his own humanity would return not in an animal body physically, but on an animal level of human existence, as a as an untutored, undisciplined, unmoralized creature. The next point that would come into focus then would have to be what the theologian is concerned about, namely, what is it that moves through these bodies? Is there a life that moves through races, nations, creatures, orders of existence, like a thread moving through a string of beads? Is there one life behind all apparent diversities of life? Some theologians, including Aquinas, have been of the opinion that there is only one life, and that finally and ultimately that life is the life of deity. That there is only one source of life and one source of universal energy, and that is this intangible, mysterious being or power or principle which we call God. Now, science has no substitute for this concept. Some scientists have attempted to explain the matter by assuming that life in its own nature is eternal, has no beginning and no end, that there never was a creation of the divine principle of things, which was a kind of great sea of eternal energy in which everything exists, has existed, and will exist throughout eternity. This, however, does not satisfy a number of human concerns, because this one energy has to in some way be conditioned, or various types of living things could not emerge from it. So it has been generally assumed by the more thoughtful of the philosophically minded people that in truth and substance, a divine being consisting of complete unconditioned consciousness, intelligence, and energy has been at the source of existence. What this is in absolute definition, we do not know. But we find it possible, convenient, and almost inevitable to regard it as deity, the one final, ultimate fact of existence. Now, in order to determine the nature of deity, we would have to, in one way or another, become aware of its own existence and the purposes and motions which are innate in it. This brings us into philosophical speculations, which also are a little difficult for modern science to accept. The problem is that to science, the ultimate is a completely impersonal energy. To the theologian, the ultimate is a purposed conscious energy. It is something that is alive and meaningful and purposeful. It is not like the gasoline in a fuel tank, something simply to be used to move a machine. This life is the sovereignty of all things, and we can go back to Pythagoras to try and find out something about ancient knowledge on this subject. To the Pythagoreans, and in their school of thinking, there is, and always has been, only one life in space. This one life in space manifests to an infinity of differentiations, with everything that is conceivable or unconceivable to man is part of the potential of this one life. This one life is all and one, all as the total of everything that exists. In one life, all things live and move and have their being. This one life cannot be analyzed by any of the fragments of itself, but it is the source of all fragmentation. This one life is not only the source of all bodies, but of minds, of souls, of spirits, and of every type of differentiation that exists in space. This one life, then, is the totality of all of the manifestations of itself, plus the nature of its own identity, which is known only to itself. Now, if we would approach this on this type of level of thought, we probably would not require any kind of a major conflict between religion and science, because it would begin with the simple realization that neither has the full knowledge, that neither science nor religion actually has the full understanding of the mystery of existence. There are two polarities involved here. Science searching for reality from the outside, religion searching for reality from the inside. To the religious person, the experience of faith is all important. To the scientist, the experience of fact is all important. But faith, in a strange way, is more available on the universal level than fact. The moment we go into the study of fact, we go against the great wall of matter. We can explore the universe scientifically only on the plane of physical existence. We can send probes further and further into space, but no matter how far we go, there will still be space, and we will not know why it is there or what its purpose is. On the other hand, if we use faith and search more and more deeply into ourselves for the answer, we discover by a mystical experience or an apperception from within our own natures, we discover certain convictions, certain feelings, certain sensory reactions, which all add up to a sense of great believing, of faith, and also the realization that this mysterious thing called ultimate knowledge is not actually necessary to us. Being imperfect creatures in our own ways, being incomplete, the full knowledge of completeness would not be suitable to our needs. What we need always is to search inside in quest of the knowledge of that which we are now and what we must do about it in order to fulfill the destiny that we understand within the span of our own existence. Science is not so emotionally involved in this matter, except on a level of debate. But the scientific point of view is that when we conquer the physical universe, we can achieve our final liberation from ignorance. The difficulty in this point of view is that there seems to be no probability that we are going to conquer the universe. What we call conquering is merely exploring and creating of hypotheses. Whatever we discover leads to another discovery, but the reality eludes us all. So science is content to go on exploring the physical dimensions of the universe and would like this to be passed on as the proper purpose for education in our public school systems, namely that we are to respect facts above all other considerations. The religionist rather takes the attitude we should respect values above all other considerations. Now, the scientific point of view has greater strength or validity if we wish to take the scientific position that the survival of life after death is an illusion. If the individual, at the end of his present life, ceases forever, and there is nothing to be gained by any idealism or any effort to release values within himself which do not have any existence except in his own mind, if this is true, then the conquest of the material becomes the sole objective of humanity. It can do no more than try to write a full description of the physical existence in which it exists. The scientific point of view, then, would impel us to advance various forms of sciences, some of which are very useful, some of which are not very useful. But the final answer is not just the scientific fact, it is utility. It is the value of it in use. If you remove from scientific progress moral integrities, you get into a very serious condition. Knowledge without integrity is deadly. No matter what skills we possess or develop, if we are not motivated to the proper use of them and not impelled by some power within ourselves to avoid the misuse or abuse of these discoveries, we will gradually undermine existence and destroy the forms of life which we have inherited from the past. So there is something necessary, and this necessary element is a communion between science and idealism. Idealism's principal exponent at the present time is religion. Religion is that factor in our behavior pattern by which we are motivated to the proper use of that which we know. As materialistic education lowers morality, we perceive in daily living the consequences. We are moving into an era of crime and corruption practically unknown in history. We have taken away from the individual the censorship of integrities. We have taken for granted that it is not whether we are good or bad that is important. It is which side has the heaviest artillery. And physical strength and the cunning to create it are the all-important elements of survival. This is simply untrue. These are the dangers which hazard survival. Now, if we could come to a mutual understanding with religion and science, in which the two decide to work together, science probing and bestowing upon religion the dignified right of interpreting all discoveries in terms of human good. If, however, science continues to ridicule religious conviction, or downgrade it, or consider it an interference with progress, then we are going to be in the position in which one day we're going to have a head-on collision between science and religion. And in this headlong collision, I think science will lose. It will lose because the collision will not occur until science itself has abused its privileges and made life practically unendurable for the human being. Also, progress exploited for profit, a partnership between knowledge and wealth. This is again disconcerting and discouraging to the average individual. So there is very much to believe that the rapid increase of interest in religious thinking is largely motivated by the fact that science is inventing a kind of progress with which the human being cannot cope and which will ultimately result in a general destruction. Science has to become moralistic. It has to place censorship upon itself. It has to apply to its own achievements a golden rule of integrities. And in order to answer the question, why integrities? The scientific, industrialized, economic community has another problem on its hands. Is it necessary for the scientist to accept theology in order to correct the processes now in action? Technically, no. It is not necessary for the scientist to become a theologian in order to recognize moral responsibility. All the scientist has to do is give a long, careful look at the consequence of what he's doing. If he can stop for a moment in his progress and realize what he is doing to humanity and not what he is doing for humanity, a great change could result. It is obvious that the present
course is a headlong course towards the deification of a planet that is nothing more than a battlefield. So we have this problem constantly, that if that a scientist can be a person of integrity. He is very likely already a person of integrity in his personal life. He may be a good family man, a good parent, a sincere son. These things are quite probable. But it is necessary for him to realize that the mind within him must be subject to something stronger than itself. And science is not sure that it believes that there is anything stronger, and is inclined to assume that the moral equation in his own nature is simply an emotional reaction to personal feelings. Actually, now, we are going to have some further delineations of these matters in the public school system. Those who are religiously minded want the theory of creation to be taught to students. The scientific community wants the theory of evolution, particularly the Darwinian form, to be the basis of human instruction. For a large measure, this entire thing is a tempest in a teapot, for the reason that neither side is in a position to scientifically prove its point, and all decision must be in terms of the greater good to the greater number. That which accomplishes the most to advance the ideals, purposes, and constructive concerns of humanity should have precedence. What does the Darwinian theory give us, or give young children who must face a life of international conflict, political corruption, economic uncertainty, and social decline? What does the Darwinian theory do to help those going to school to build lives that are purposeful? The purpose of education is to teach the human being to use the knowledge of his race. If he does not use it, is not impelled to use it, is not inspired to use it, that education fails. And if by a mistaken attitude he accepts, learns, and uses that which is destructive to the common good, he becomes a menace rather than a benefit to the world. Therefore, what has the scientific theory of evolution going to do to the person who is going out to make a living? What is it going to do to him to be a materialist, to decline to accept as superstition anything that is not obvious to his five senses and the scientific community? The answer is it's going to do him very little good. He will never find security in any of the advancements of science. One thing it can do for him, and that is it can help him to protect, preserve, and use the body that he has. But even this is hazarded by many kinds of selfishness on the part of the intellectual group. Theoretically, science can help us, but it can help us principally on the level of body. It can help us to use the structure that we have and to repair it if it is in danger of sickness or dissolution. It can help. But as far as the scientific point of view, giving us personal integrity, giving us happiness in our homes, giving us better-oriented children, and a willingness to cooperate for a common good, it does not help us to solve international conflicts. It does not help us to improve political relationships. It does not make our statesmen more honest. It does not make our citizens more frugal or cooperative. All of these things are outside of the scientific domain. They are assumed, as one biologist told me, that the scientist is a teacher of the public, and private morals depend upon individuals themselves. This is a very poor answer to a very immediate question. as the depression increases, as unemployment rises, as human securities are threatened, what is science doing to meet the emergency? It is going to continue what it has always done, to advance scientific skills and try to convince us that if it can put a man on Pluto, that all is well in the world. This is very attractive to juveniles who have a great respect for Superman and all of these scientific robots that are being fashioned in the entertainment world. But down to the solid facts of life, no science is important or valuable until it is ensouled. Ensouling the science means its dedication to the service of human need. Science does not exist to glorify itself. It does not exist to create profit for corporations. Science exists primarily to improve humanity's relationship with itself on the levels of family, home, health, and other problems. Science must be ensouled, or soullessly it will destroy itself. Now, on the other side of the coin, what are we going to do about the religious group? It is interesting to realize that we often say that the scientist, particularly the scientific community, is the only international, interracial body that we have. It does not make much difference whether you live in a kingdom, a democracy, or a communist state. Biologists get together from all these different points of view and do their research programs. They share knowledge, they research projects, and they pay practically no attention to the political and social relationships of the communities in which they live. They are therefore regarded as a super group, a group welcome in China or Russia or France or Italy, wherever they may be. Now, religion has one difficulty in this particular point. Religion has not yet been able to consolidate its own strength. Religion has not yet come to the realization of the unity of the concept of God. Religions still have interpretations that are in conflict. Now, conflict in interpretation is due largely to the absence of basic fact, or it can arise from language differences or from social and climatic differences. But regardless of the origin, the various parts of the religious community cannot cooperate effectively, at least they do not cooperate at the present time. Therefore, we have several major world religions, all dedicated to the same moral and social ends, all very largely worshiping the same concepts of divinity and its operations in creation, yet unable to meet upon any common ground. And why this inability to meet? It is the result of a long traditional theological structure in which each faith firmly believes that it was predestined and foreordained to rule the world. Now, this type of situation is the great weakness of religion. Religion has not yet been able to break through a peculiar physical belief that really should have long ago passed into the keeping of science. Namely, that it is perfectly possible to consider deity simply to be an expanded, unfolded, dramatized form of human being. The deities of the past were deified mortals, or at least had this general appearance. We have not yet come to the realization of the nature of the ultimate cause of things. Science doesn't know what it is, and theology doesn't know what it is. theology has been locked in theological structures which have differed as to the nature of God sufficiently to create creeds, sects, and religious divisions. Science has not been any more successful. And here are the two groups. Science trying to get out of the dilemma by denying the existence of conflict, and religion trying to get out of the dilemma by continually warring in order that one can control the others. So we have a little problem here that comes down to our personal living in a great many cases. Here we are as individuals in a world of which our bodies are largely dominated by science and our hearts and minds largely inclined toward religion. And in the midst of this situation is this grave question at the moment, a question that has really very little significance, as to the nature of our own essential beings. What is man, says the scripture, that thou shalt be mindful of him? Well, what is man? What is humanity? Scientifically, he is merely a precocious biped without feathers. According to theology, he is the noblest production of deity. Actually, what is the human being and how should he view himself? If he doesn't respect his own nature, if he doesn't have any convictions that are worthwhile, how can he regulate and control and direct his own life? In looking around into the animal kingdom in which surrounds us, we observe that between the human being and the animal, there is an incredible, insurmountable obstacle. There is no way of assuming that the human being is simply a highly sophisticated animal. When we study the animal kingdom, we come into a realization that if the animal had the same potential faculties and powers that we have, he would have run humanity off the planet long ago. We are outnumbered by everything from bees to ants and major quadrupeds. We are a minority group in a vast system of life. We are yet in a unique position. One of the reasons for our misunderstandings, I think, has been our tendency to humanize the animal. In other words, we talk to cats and dogs. Probably they may understand some of it. Perhaps, however, it isn't the talk they understand. Perhaps they have a psychic integration that gets the message. Many of them are very faithful to humanity. And yet between man and the animal, there are certain differences which is impossible to cross. One of these differences is thought, the individual power of the mind. In order to be human, the individual has memory. He has also the power mentally of projecting a future, which gives him the privilege to improve, change, and modify his own existence. The human being is the only creature that we know in the visible world which is capable of self-directive, that is capable of dominating a situation, and most of all, of verbalizing it. Speech has separated man from the animal from the beginning. And while the animal is a very lovable and wonderful creature in many instances, it is not right either to us or to the animal for us to assume that we are directly bound to them by a biological factor. Let us assume then the fact as it is, that two orders of evolution are working at the same time in nature. One is physical evolution. Here Mr. Darwin had something on his mind and he really made an important contribution. In other words, nature is continually unfolding bodies. and these bodies move from one degree of efficiency to another, and the most efficient and complex and useful physical body ever created is that of the human being. In the human being, there are potentials which are latent in all lesser animal or plant, vegetable, mineral forms. Physical evolution is producing nobler mansions, but there is not anything to indicate here that this physical evolution does control that which is in the body. The ancients would have agreed, largely, that evolution of form is inevitable and proper, but that the evolution of life through form is a separate function. That which form makes possible, the house that form builds, has its proper occupant. And each order of life is a level of internal life development and unfoldment. Therefore, what we call the human being is not the body, but the life moving through that body. A life which has fashioned gradually the form we call human through long periods of evolution, and a life which adjusts the new body with each embodiment to the needs and characteristics and qualities of its own purposes. Therefore, the higher form of evolution is the evolution of life. The lower form is the evolution of bodies. These two work together. And each time an embodiment occurs, that which enters in belongs to the proper level of life. Only the human being can enter into the human form because of the unfoldment and evolvement of its superphysical structure. Therefore, we think of it and refer to it very often theologically as man being a body and soul. And it is the soul in the body that makes it human. And it is the human soul that makes the human being possible. It is the animal soul that makes the animal possible. The both points of view have certain integrities, but to attempt to unite them and assume that the body and the dweller in the flesh, that these are identical, is against practically every system of rationalistic thinking the world has ever created. The human being is human and is born and bred by human parents and receives its gift of a human life spark. And this humanity is that which inhabits the body after the quickening and gradually molds it into the purposes of the incarnating entity. The body is definitely traceable back through all the forms of life that have been found before. And psychologically, we can trace the life principle back through the various levels of life. But unfortunately, we are unable to experience directly any level of life except our own. We cannot relive the life of a plant or an animal, because actually we are not part of those kingdoms. But we can, from an outward study of the forms of these creatures, understand something of the life in them, because this life is manifested in their functions and in their processes and in the circumstances which they impel into existence. Therefore, it would seem that religion and philosophy are especially related to the person in the body, the being that is in the flesh, whereas the body itself is a proper subject for physical scientific consideration. It can be helped. It can be more valuable in its needs. It can be served by the physical. Science can help to make the house better for the person dwelling in it. But no matter how much it improves the house, It cannot control, direct, or dominate the life of the occupant, because the occupant has an entirely different level of function. Actually, we also have a tendency in trying to understand these things of assuming that all forms of consciousness in nature are identical with our own. This is probably an erroneous conclusion. What we call consciousness is our own experience of the function of the life principle within us. For us, consciousness expresses itself through the ego, through the mind, through the emotions, through the vital resources of the body. And it is this dweller in the flesh that helps us to choose our careers, that helps us to decide and evaluate experiences, and this factor helps us to grow inwardly through the internalization of things that happen in our environment. In other words, the purpose of the body is to help the power in the body to become more and more sufficient to its own needs. If, for instance, the body gets into difficulties, as for instance in drug addiction, the being in the body must accept the challenge of this and either produce its own remedy. It must rise above this delinquency. It must learn to know the troubles that result from such addictions. And failing to note these things, it finally passes out of life, destroyed by its own weakness, selfishness, or misunderstanding. Now again, science says when it leaves, that's all there is to it. This again is contrary to every legitimate purpose of a natural phenomenon, that the individual, having passed through a whole variety of experiences, should then disappear forever, cease to exist, and have no future being of any kind. This seems to be a position that cannot be tolerated philosophically. This brings philosophy into focus as the power to bring together the scientific and the religious points of view. As philosophy becomes the reconciler of opposites, it becomes, in a sense, the mediator between all extremes in life. All philosophy worthy of the name, and it's not too abundant at the present time, all philosophy deals with the problem of adequate purpose. Things that happen, happen for a reason. There is no waste motion in life. There are no occurrences that are meaningless. Everything has significance of some kind. Everything that happens in the outer life affects the inner person within that body. Every attitude, every contact with society modifies the pattern of the person in the body. When the time comes for the person and the body to separate, the person survives. And more, even the scientific communion is beginning to assume the possibility of life after death. Life after death was accepted by our most primitive ancestors. It has always been known intuitively as part of our eternal realities. But up to recently, it has been considered unscientific, perhaps because, as one prominent educator said of it, that philosophy and idealism was a sickly mysticism that interfered with the glory of facts. Well, the glory of facts look rather shabby at the moment. The glory is not noticeable. But the fact of the matter is that unless we are here for a purpose, the entire existence of living things has no meaning whatsoever. And having no meaning, there is no hope. For if there is no meaning, no reason, no methodology by which anything can be accomplished, then we live and die in a state of complete bewilderment and have been exploited from the cradle to the grave. Such is not the case, fortunately, for all concerned. And it is obvious that the experiences of a lifetime are not kept in record in the body alone. The body does not know anything about how we felt about our neighbors, except that when we feel wrongly about our neighbors, the body knows something is wrong. But it does not gain moral instruction from the happenings of the person in the body. But the vibration of the person in the body, if it becomes better and higher, does elevate gradually the bodily elements and puts the bodily cells into an inhabitable universe of their own. It prevents the destruction of the multitude forms of life within our own flesh. If we then assume, as is almost necessary, that there is something beyond the present, then in a large measure the whole structure of science falls apart. Because if there is something more in life or to life than the immediate frenzied accumulation of wealth or power, then we have been living falsely from the beginning, and science has been trying to build up something that cannot survive. It is therefore very important for us to try to ensoul the world in which we live. And I think that really, of the animals and other kingdoms of nature, man becomes symbolically a conscious ensoulment of life as this ensoulment develops on this level of existence. In other words, man represents more or less a soul power in the material world. The power of inner consciousness, inner dedication, inner understanding and realization to transmute and transform the outer environment into an appropriate and proper place for the development of life. The human being has tremendous potentials. These potentials include a number of faculties, not only of communication, but of memory, of ideation, of internal mysticism. It makes possible the rise of esoteric disciplines, sciences, and philosophies. It definitely indicates that gradually the human being is able to take over his own destiny. This is something that sets him entirely apart from every other kingdom of nature. There is no other kingdom that we know that can create a future destiny for itself by intent, that can take the rough materials of life and ensoul them with purposes beyond survival. The other kingdoms are largely tied into a survival pattern, which is always present, is always dominant, and requires practically the entire life of the living creature. The animal kingdoms live in one or two principles alone. They have to feed, they must have nutrition, and they have to generate and reproduce. Food and reproductive power constitute the burden which all kingdoms below man must carry. Now, this doesn't mean that man doesn't have to carry them also, but it means that man is capable of a complete life above them. The human being is not required to spend all of his life feeding himself and that alone, nor is he required to exist only to the point of generation or perpetuation of species and then an immediate departure. The human being has other overtones which must be developed or can be developed by the proper aptitudes and the proper dedications. The human being has a life fulfillment within itself. It has a duty to itself, which is another form of nutrition. Man's material nature perpetuates the species, man's soul perpetuates and unfolds itself by a psychic nutrition, the nutrition of ideals, of dreams, of hopes, of aspirations, and of dedications. As the old story of the Greek banquet tells us, there is food for the body, but there is also the banquet of the soul, a kind of holy communion in which the individual nourishes the inner life by the merits of its own conduct, by its dreams, its aspirations, and its dedications. So that this means definitely that the human being was created or fashioned or evolved or whatever you want to call it for a purpose that is unique in nature. It is because of this uniqueness in nature that the human being controls or is capable of controlling every other form of life. It cannot create another form of life, but it can direct it, unfold its resources, it can curb it or expand it, it can give it greater opportunity or destroy its privileges. The human being is in a strange way, is the leader of this herd of souls that we find embodied in the kingdoms of nature. Therefore, man is a unique creature. It is not possible to assume that we can explain man merely as an animal with one step further ahead. It is not only this, it is a completely different organization. Not physically, but because it contains within it a being more highly devolved and developed than any other creature that has created a visible likeness among us. Man has the tremendous advantage of being capable of creating not only materially but spiritually. Not only generating forms but generating ideas, capable of reproduction in an internal spiritual sense of that term. Because of this, the individual also has appropriate responsibilities. He is faced with the duties of his own identity. If his duties were simply to feed and generate, we'd have no little problem, because animals don't have too much problems of this nature. They have their territories, and they abide by them, and they follow laws and instincts which are immutable. Man is not a servant of instincts that he is unable to direct or control. The human being is a self-moving mechanism. It is a being capable of unfolding higher levels than any other kingdom that we know. But in order to do this, the individual must have some motivation. And our school children need motivation. Young people today and older folks too need some form of motivation which will enable them to live above and beyond physical pressures. To lock the soul within the body after it has been given dominion over it is a sad mistake. And yet in most people, the soul is merely an energy which is a servant of desires, ambitions, and personal feelings. The soul is not being permitted to perform its essential duty of directing the life within the person and protecting the body in which that life is enclosed. So man has to improve from within out. He has to lead from the soul and not from the body. He has to use the mind and emotions to advance the universal good and not merely to further little small selfish projects of his own. Yet if we are so educated that little things are all that we ever learn of, if it is assumed that importance simply consists in doing what we please, then we have missed the entire purpose of our existence. Nature, however, is not going to be frustrated so easily. If the individual or a generation or a race or a species fails completely in its purposes, nature simply eliminates it. We have lost the dinosaurs, we have lost the Megatheriums and the Brontosauruses because they were no longer useful, because they contributed nothing to the plans and purposes of life. We are watching species and types fading away today because they have no further need for the experience of this environment. Man, however, has not achieved a diploma of graduation. He is not, as yet, using his potentials and his purposes correctly. And young people should be told this. They should not be so much concerned as to where they came from in terms of the Darwinian theory, but where they're going in terms of cosmic purpose. This is the emphasis. Every young person should be taught the dignity of his own contribution to life. He should be taught that there is within him something that he can use to better others and serve himself in this way. That he is not here simply to get rich or powerful. He is not going to be a success because he is a computer operator. He is here to grow, not only in skills, but in grace. And his skills should be under the domination of his integrities. The more proficient he becomes in some line of activity, the greater the contribution he can make to enduring good, not merely to some passing project that seems to have economic possibilities. We have great need to give young people reason for life. And today this idea of trying to create an arbitration between the theory of generation and the theory of creation and let the children decide which to follow is not very practical, for the reason that the average child can't decide. They have not the experience, they have not the background. It seems to me that the arbitration lies on an entirely different level, namely that the purpose of science is to invent and discover. The purpose of religion is to learn to use wisely and unselfishly all the skills of mankind. Therefore, religion is involved in the use of that which science may claim to discover. Religion makes things valuable to the survival of life on this planet. Knowledge is increasing very rapidly, but unless integrity grows with it, we cannot depend upon a livable future. So maybe it would be just as well to not try to force which one is correct, but to point out that each of these courses of action, creation and generation, each has a practical, visual, and moral term which it can fulfill. Therefore, that instead of trying to decide which is the best of them, let us form a partnership between the two concepts. Let science keep on exploring, and let religion or philosophy apply what is found to the common good. But if science insists that any constructive use of its discoveries is an interference with the right of discovery, then we are in trouble again. It should be that whatever science finds, it should allow human experience to apply for the common good. It is useless to assume that integrity is an interference with progress. It is not. It is the integrity that makes change progress. And without integrity, change is nothing. We can add all we want to the so-called skills of mankind. But if these skills are not ennobled by purpose, all is in vain. And there is no reason why the scientist who likes to explore and discover should not even more greatly rejoice when he realizes that what he is discovering is going to be used for the good of mankind. And if that enjoyment and that power does not arise in his own thinking, then he is not a safe citizen of the world. if he does not want what he invents to be used well, he should not be permitted to carry on these projects. And if it becomes necessary, because of his own misuse of knowledge, to put some censorship upon these matters, then it is for his good as well as for the good of others. For the scientist who goes on with his nuclear research may live to see it destroy his own children. This type of situation is not good. Materialism has always been faced with it, and religion has always come forward to meet this emergency. And the greatly increasing interest in religion that we have at the present time is the result of the fact that progress as we know it is becoming too dangerous, and that unless it is curbed in some way, unless some form of inner reality comes into existence, we are all in trouble. And both religion and philosophy suspect profoundly that this tremendous energy, which we call life, this power that makes all things possible, is not a blind force. That it is also a conscious moral energy, and that all energy has in its very substance and essence a soul factor. It is an ensouled energy which creates. It is an ensouled energy which generates. And if energy is used by created creatures or generated beings against the use of its own proper values, energy itself can revolt, and energy itself can remove itself from that which abuses it, or falsely uses it, or corrupts it, or perverts it. So that little by little, the tremendous censorship of the infinite comes upon us. And in order to meet that censorship with integrity, I think we have to realize that man is a living soul, that his body is of the earth, to which it will return. But his soul belongs to an higher order of life, which is moving triumphantly toward the perfection and service of the divine plan. We live in these two levels. We must balance them within ourselves. And if one is to gain advantage over the other, it must be the power of the soul to win the body, to take the body and make it an instrument of the purpose of that divine part of man, which is his hope of glory. If we can begin to think these things through, we will not be impractical, but we will realize that a practical philosophy of life must justify life, must make it meaningful and worthwhile, must make also a progress, which we can all share and all labor together for the common good. If we take these points into consideration, we probably can make a comparative link between science and religion. That we will render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. And that includes body, wealth, physical environment. But also, at the same time, can render unto God the things that are his. And if we want to assume that the material world belongs to the deities of the underlife, at the same time, there is a superior world. And man, as a creature, has been endowed with the power to know this. And of all the creatures that we know, man alone has the hope of a greater destiny. He is the one being who is able to change all things for the good. And if he does not use this energy, there is stagnation. If he perverts it, there is disintegration. It is a part of our plan to realize that man is not an animal. Man is a being dedicated to the service of that which his inner life has revealed to him. And if he makes proper use of this inner life, his outer life will be orderly, proper, and constructive. If we control the negative factors of our own dispositions, we can live in a world in peace with each other and in harmony with the divine purpose. Well, I guess that's it, folks.
I hope everybody enjoyed that. That was Freemason Manly P. Hall. The lecture is called Darwinism, I Beg to Differ. So, anyway, I would suggest going back and listen to the article that I read at the beginning after that. So I'm going to go ahead and close out the show. So again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Some final thoughts. Truth does not fear investigation. Belief is when someone else does the thinking. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. There is no higher religion than truth. Religion leads to racial death. Racial death is forever. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan. I'm going to go out with some more Led Zeppelin. We'll be right back.
Your Inteller.
Satan! Satan! Satan!